as it sped away. "Idiot," Alex muttered. "I should get his plate number." She broke off when she realized that Josie had vanished. "Josie!" Then Alex saw her daughter, pressed against the sidewalk where she'd flattened herself. Her face was white, her body trembling. Alex knelt beside her. "It was a car. Just a car." She helped Josie to her knees. All around them, people were watching and pretending not to. Alex shielded Josie from their view. She had failed again. For someone renowned for her good judgment, she suddenly seemed to be lacking any. She thought of something she'd read on the internet, how sometimes, when it came to grief, you could take one step forward and then three steps back. She wondered why the internet didn't add that when someone you loved was hurting, it cut you right to the bone, too. "All right," Alex said, her arm anchored tight around Josie's shoulders. "Let's get you back home." Patrick had taken to living, eating, and sleeping his case. At the station, he acted cool and in command. He was the point man, after all, for all those investigators. But at home, he questioned every move he made. On his refrigerator were the pictures of the dead. On his bathroom mirror, he'd created a dry erase marker timeline of Peter's day. He sat awake in the middle of the night, writing lists of questions. What was Peter doing at home before leaving for school? What else was on his computer? Where did he learn to shoot? How did he get guns? Where did the anger come from? During the day, however, he plowed through the massive amount of information to be processed and the even more massive amount of information to be gleaned. Now, Joan McCabe sat across from him. She had cried her way through the last box of Kleenex at the station and was now wadding paper towels up in her fist. "I'm sorry," she said to Patrick. "I thought this would get easier the more I do it." "I don't think that's how it works," he said gently. "I do appreciate you taking the time to speak to me about your brother." Ed McCabe had been the only teacher killed in the shooting. His classroom had been at the top of the stairs, en route to the gymnasium. He'd had the bad fortune to come out and try to stop what was happening. According to school records, Peter had had McCabe as a math teacher in 10th grade. He'd gotten B's. No one else could remember his not getting along with McCabe that year. Most of the other students hadn't even recalled Peter being in the class. "There's really nothing else I can tell you," Joan said. "Maybe Philip remembers something."
"Your husband?"
Joan looked up at him.
"No, that's Ed's partner."
Patrick leaned back in his chair.
"Partner, as in?"
"Ed was gay," Joan said.
It might be something, but then again, it might not. For all Patrick knew, Ed McCabe, who'd been just a hapless victim a half hour ago, could have been the reason Peter started shooting.
"No one at the school knew," Joan said. "I think he was afraid of backlash. He told people in town that Philip was his old college roommate."
Another victim, one who was still alive, was Natalie Zelenko. She'd been shot in the side and had to have her liver resected. Patrick thought he remembered seeing her name listed as president of the GLAD Club at Sterling High. She'd been one of the first people shot. McCabe had been one of the last. Maybe Peter Houghton was homophobic. Patrick handed Joan his card.
"I'd really like to talk to Philip," he said.
Lacey Houghton set a teapot and a plate of celery in front of Selena.
"I don't have any milk. I went to buy some, but..."
Her voice trailed off, and Selena tried to fill in the blanks.
"I really appreciate you talking to me," Selena said. "Whatever you can tell me, we'll use to help Peter."
Lacey nodded.
"Anything,"
she said.
Anything you want to know.
Well, let's start with the easy stuff. Where was he born?
Right at Dartmouth, Hitchcock, Lacey said.
Normal delivery?
Totally. No complications.
She smiled a little.
I used to walk 3 miles every day when I was pregnant. Lewis thought I'd wind up delivering in someone's driveway.
Did you nurse him? Was he a good eater?
I'm sorry, I don't see why.
Because we have to see if there might be a brain disorder, Selena said matter-of-factly. An organic problem.
Oh, Lacey said faintly.
Yes, I nursed him. He's always been healthy, a little smaller than other kids his age, but neither Lewis nor I are very big people.
How was his social development as a child?
He didn't have a lot of friends, Lacey said.
Not like Joey.
Joey?
Peter's older brother. Peter is a year younger, and much quieter. He got teased because of his size, and because he wasn't as good an athlete as Joey.
What kind of relationship does Peter have with Joey?
Lacey looked down at her knotted hands. Joey died a year ago. He was killed in a car accident by a drunk driver.
Selena stopped writing.
I'm so sorry.
Yes, Lacey said.
Me too.
Selena leaned back slightly in her chair. It was crazy, she knew, but just in case misfortune was contagious, she didn't want to get too close. She thought of Sam, how she'd left him sleeping this morning in his crib. During the night, he'd kicked off a sock. His toes were plump as early peas. It was all she could do not to taste his caramel skin. So much of the language of love was like that. You devoured someone with your eyes. You drank in the sight of him. You swallowed him whole. Love was sustenance, broken down and beating through your bloodstream. She turned back to Lacey.
Did Peter get along with Joey?
Oh, Peter adored his big brother.
He told you that?
Lacey shrugged.
He didn't have to. He'd be at all of Joey's football games and cheering just as loud as the rest of us. When he got to the high school, everyone expected great things of him because he was Joey's little brother.
Which could be, Selena knew, just as much a source of frustration as it was of pride.
How did Peter react to Joey's death?
He was devastated, just like we were. He cried a lot, spent time in his room.
Did your relationship with Peter change after Joey died?
I think it got stronger, Lacey said.
I was so overwhelmed. Peter, he let us lean on him.
Did he lean on anyone else? Have any intimate relationships?
You mean with girls?
Or boys, Selena said.
He was still at that awkward age. I know he'd asked a few girls out, but I don't think anything ever came of it.
How were Peter's grades?
He wasn't a straight-A student like his brother, Lacey said.
But he'd get B's and the occasional C. We always told him to just do the best he could.
Did he have any learning disabilities?
No.
What about outside of school? What did he like to do? Selena asked.
He'd listen to music, play video games, like any other teenager.
Did you ever listen to his music or play those games?
Lacey let a smile ghost over her face.
I actively tried not to.
Did you monitor his internet use?
He was only supposed to be using it for school projects. We had long talks about chat rooms and how unsafe the internet can be, but Peter had a good head on his shoulders.
She broke off, looking away.
We trusted him.
Did you know what he was downloading?
No.
What about weapons? Do you know where he got them from?
Lacey took a deep breath.
Lewis hunts. He took Peter out with him once, but Peter didn't like it very much. The shotguns are always locked in a gun case.
And Peter knew where the key was.
Yes, Lacey murmured.
What about the pistols?
We'd never had those in our house. I have no idea where they came from.
Did you ever check his room? Under the bed, in the closets, that kind of thing?
Lacey met her gaze.
We've always respected his privacy. I think it's important for a child to have his own space, and...
She pressed her lips shut.
And?
And sometimes when you start looking, Lacey said softly, you find things you don't really want to see.
Selena leaned forward, her elbows on her knees. When did that happen, Lacey?
Lacey walked to the window, drawing aside the curtain.
You would have had to know Joey to understand. He was a senior, an honors student, an athlete. And then, a week before graduation, he was killed.
She let her hand trail the edge of the fabric.
Someone had to go through his room, pack it up, get rid of the things we didn't want to keep. It took me a while, but finally I did it. I was going through his drawers when I found the drugs. Just a little powder in a gum wrapper and a spoon and a needle. I didn't know it was heroin until I looked it up on the internet. I flushed it down the toilet and threw the hypodermic out at work.
She turned toward Selena, her face red.
I can't believe I'm telling you this. I've never told anyone, not even Lewis. I didn't want him, or anyone, to think anything bad about Joey.
Lacey sat down on the couch again.
I didn't go into Peter's room on purpose, because I was afraid of what I'd find, she confessed. I didn't know that it could be even worse.
Did you ever interrupt him when he was in his room? Knock on the door, pop your head inside?
Sure. I'd come in to say goodnight.
What was he usually doing?
He was on his computer, Lacey said. Almost always.
Didn't you see what was on the screen?
I don't know. He'd close the file.
How did he act when you interrupted him unexpectedly? Did he seem upset, annoyed, guilty?
Why does it feel like you're judging him? Lacey said. Aren't you supposed to be on our side?
Selena met her gaze steadily.
The only way I can thoroughly investigate this case is to ask you the facts, Mrs. Houghton. That's all I'm doing. He was like any other teenager, Lacey said. He'd suffer while I kissed him goodnight. He didn't seem embarrassed. He didn't act like he was hiding anything from me. Is that what you want to know?
Selena put down her pen. When the subject started getting defensive, it was time to end the interview. But Lacey was still talking, unprompted.
I never thought there was any problem, she admitted. I didn't know Peter was upset. I didn't know he wanted to kill himself. I didn't know any of those things.
She began to cry.
All those families out there. I don't know what to say to them. I wish I could tell them that I lost someone, too. I just lost him a long time ago.
Selena folded her arms around the smaller woman.
It's not your fault, she said.
Words she knew Lacey Houghton needed to hear. In a fit of high school irony, the principal of Sterling High had placed the Bible Study Club next door to the Gay and Lesbian Alliance. They met Tuesdays at 3:30 in rooms 233 and 234 of the high school. Room 233 was, during the day, Ed McCabe's classroom. One member of the Bible Study Club was the daughter of a local minister named Grace Murtaugh. She'd been killed in the hallway leading to the gymnasium, shot in front of a water fountain. The leader of the Gay and Lesbian Alliance was still in the hospital. Natalie Zelenko, a yearbook photographer, had come out as a lesbian after her freshman year when she had wandered into the GLAD meeting in room 233 to see if there was anyone else on this planet like herself.
We're not supposed to give out names.
Natalie's voice was so faint that Patrick had to lean over the hospital bed to hear her. Natalie's mother hovered at his shoulder. When he'd come in to ask Natalie a few questions, she said that he'd better leave or else she'd call the police. He reminded her that he was the police.
I'm not asking for names, Patrick said. I'm just asking you to help me help a jury understand why this happened.
Natalie nodded. She closed her eyes.
Peter Houghton, Patrick said. Did he ever attend a meeting?
Once,
Natalie said.
Did he say or do anything that sticks in your mind?
He didn't say or do anything, period. He showed up the one time, and he never came back.
Does that happen often?
Sometimes,
Natalie said.
People wouldn't be ready to come out, and sometimes we got jerks who just wanted to know who was gay so that they could make life hell for us in school.
In your opinion, did Peter fit into either one of these categories?
She was silent for a long time, her eyes still closed. Patrick drew away, thinking that she'd fallen asleep.
Thanks, he said to her mother, just as Natalie spoke again.
Peter was getting ragged on long before he ever showed up at that meeting, she said.
Jordan was on diaper detail while Selena interviewed Lacey Houghton, and Sam was appallingly bad at going to sleep on his own. However, a 10-minute ride in the car could knock the kid out like a prize fighter, so Jordan bundled the baby up and strapped him into the car seat. It wasn't until he put the Saab into reverse that he realized his wheel rims were grinding against the driveway. All four of his tires had been slashed.
Fuck,
Jordan said, as Sam started to wail again in the back seat. He plucked the baby out, carried him back inside, and tethered him into the snuggly that Selena wore around the house. Then he called the police to report the vandalism. Jordan knew he was in trouble when the dispatch officer didn't ask him to spell his last name. He already knew it.
We'll get to it, the officer said. But first we've got a squirrel up a tree that needs a hand climbing down.
The line went dead. Could you sue the cops for being unsympathetic bastards? Through some miracle, pheromones of stress, probably, Sam fell asleep, but startled, bawling, when the doorbell rang. Jordan yanked the door open to find Selena outside.
You woke up the baby, he accused as she lifted Sam out of the carrier.
Then you shouldn't have locked the door. Oh, hi, you sweet man, Selena cooed. Has Daddy been a monster the whole time I've been gone?
Someone slashed my tires.
Selena glanced at him over the baby's head.
Well, you sure know how to win friends and influence people. Let me guess, the cops aren't exactly scrambling to take your report?
Not quite.
Comes with the territory, I guess, Selena said. You're the one who took this case.
How about a little spousal understanding?
Selena shrugged.
Wasn't in the vows I took. If you want to have a pity party, set the table for one.
Jordan ran a hand through his hair.
Well, did you at least get anything out of the mother? Like, for example, that Peter had a psychiatric diagnosis?
She peeled off her jacket while juggling Sam in one hand, and then with the other, unbuttoned her blouse and sat down on the couch to nurse.
No, but he did have a sibling.
Really?
Yeah, a dead one, who, prior to being killed by a drunk driver, was the all-American son.
Jordan sank down beside her.
I can use this.
Selena rolled her eyes.
Just for once, could you not be a lawyer and focus instead on being a human? Jordan, this family was in so deep they didn't have a chance. The kid was a powder keg. The parents were dealing with their own grief and were asleep at the wheel. Peter had no one to turn to.
Jordan glanced up at her, a grin splitting his face.
Excellent, he said. Our clients just become sympathetic.
1 week after the school shooting at Sterling High, the Mount Lebanon School, a primary grade school that had become an administrative building when the population of students in Lebanon dipped, was outfitted to be the temporary home for high school kids to finish out their school year. On the day that classes were beginning again, Josie's mother came into her bedroom.
You don't have to do this, she said. You can take a few more weeks off if you want.
There had been a flurry of phone calls, a pulse of panic that began a few days ago when each student received the written word that school would be starting again.
Are you going back? Are you?
There were rumors. Whose mother wouldn't let them return? Who was getting transferred to St. Mary's? Who was going to take over Mr. McCabe's class? Josie hadn't called any of her friends. She was afraid to hear their answers. Josie didn't want to go back to school. She couldn't imagine having to walk down a hallway, even one not physically located at Sterling High. She didn't know how the superintendent and the principal expected everyone to act, and they all would be doing that. Acting. Because to feel anything real would be devastating. And yet there was another part of Josie that understood she had to go back to school. It was where she belonged. The other students at Sterling High were the only ones who really understood what it was like to wake up in the morning and crave those 3 seconds before you remembered your life wasn't what it used to be. Who had forgotten how easy it was to trust that the ground beneath your feet was solid. If you were drifting with 1,000 other people, could you really still say you were lost?
Josie,
her mother said, prompting.
It's fine, she lied.
Her mother left and Josie started to gather her books. She realized, suddenly, that she'd never taken her science test. Catalysts. She didn't remember anything about them anymore. Mrs. Duplessier wouldn't be evil enough to hand out the test on their first day back, would she? It wasn't like time had stopped during these 3 weeks. It had changed completely. The last morning she had gone to school, she hadn't been thinking of anything in particular. That test, maybe. Matt. How much homework she'd have that night. Normal things, in other words. A normal day. There had been nothing to set it apart from any other morning at school. So how could Josie be sure that today wouldn't dissolve at the seams, too? When Josie reached the kitchen, her mother was wearing a suit. Work clothes. It took her by surprise.
You're going back today?
She asked. Her mother turned, holding a spatula.
Oh,
she answered, faltering.
I just figured that since you were... You can always reach me through the clerk if there's a problem. I swear to God, Josie, I'll be there in less than 10 minutes.
Josie sank into a chair and closed her eyes. Somehow, it didn't matter that Josie herself was leaving the house for the day. She'd still imagined her mother sitting home waiting for her, just in case. But that was stupid, wasn't it? It had never been like that, so why should now be any different?
Because, a voice whispered in Josie's head, everything else is.
I've rearranged my schedule so I'll be able to pick you up from school, and if there's any problem...
Yeah, call the clerk, whatever.
Her mother sat down across from her.
Honey, what did you expect?
Josie glanced up.
Nothing. I stopped that a long time ago.
She stood up.
You're burning your pancakes, she said,
and she walked back upstairs to her bedroom. She buried her face in her pillow. She didn't know what the hell was wrong with her. It was as if, after, there were 2 Josies. The little girl who kept hoping it might be a nightmare, might never have happened, and the realist who still hurt so badly she lashed out at anyone who got too close. The thing was, Josie didn't know which persona was going to take over at any given moment. Here was her mother, for God's sake, who couldn't boil water, but was now attempting pancakes for Josie before she went back to school. When she was younger, she had imagined living in the kind of house where on the first day of school, your mother had a whole spread of eggs and bacon and juice to start the day off right, instead of a lineup of cereal boxes and a paper napkin. Well, she'd gotten what she wished for, hadn't she? A mother who sat at her bedside when she was crying, a mother who had temporarily abandoned the job that defined her to hover over Josie instead. And what did Josie do? She pushed her away. She said, in all the spaces between her words, "You never cared about anything that happened in my life when nobody was watching, so don't think you can just start now." Suddenly, Josie heard the roar of an engine pulling into the driveway. "Matt," she thought, before she could stop herself. And by then, every nerve in her body was stretched to the point of pain. Somehow, she hadn't really thought about how she would physically be transported to school. Matt had always picked her up en route. Her mother, of course, would have driven her. But Josie wondered why she hadn't worked through these logistics earlier. Because she was afraid to? Didn't want to? From her bedroom window, she watched Drew Girard get out of his battered Volvo. By the time she reached the front door to open it, her mother had come out of the kitchen, too. She held the smoke detector in her hand, popped off its plastic snap on the ceiling. Drew stood in a shaft of sunlight, shading his eyes with his free hand. His other arm was still in a sling. "I should have called." "That's okay," Josie said. She felt dizzy. She realized that, in the background, the birds had come back from wherever they went in the winter. Drew looked from Josie to her mother. "I thought maybe, you know, you might need a ride." Suddenly Matt was standing there with them. Josie could feel his fingers on her back. "Thanks," her mother said, "but I'm going to take Josie in today." The monster in Josie uncoiled. "I'd rather go with Drew," she said, grabbing her backpack off the newel post of the banister. "I'll see you at pickup." Without turning around to see her mother's face, Josie ran to the car, which gleamed like a sanctuary. Inside, she waited for Drew to turn over the ignition and pull out of the driveway. "Are your parents like that?" Josie asked, closing her eyes as they sped down the street. "Like you can't breathe?" Drew glanced at her.
"Yeah."
"Have you talked to anyone?"
"Like the police?"
Josie shook her head.
"Like us?"
He downshifted.
"I went over to the hospital to see John a couple of times," Drew said. "He couldn't remember my name. He can't remember the words for things like forks or hairbrushes or stairs. I kind of sat there and told him stupid things, who'd won the last few Bruins games, things like that. But the whole time I was wondering if he even knows he can't walk anymore."
At a stoplight, Drew turned to her.
"Why not me?"
"What?
How come we got to be the lucky ones?"
Josie didn't know what to say to that. She looked out the window, pretending to be fascinated by a dog that was pulling its owner instead of the other way around. Drew pulled into the parking lot of the Mount Lebanon School. Beside the building was a playground. This had been an elementary school, after all, and even once it became administrative, neighborhood kids would still come to use the monkey bars and the swings. In front of the school's main doors stood the principal and a line of parents, calling out the names of students and encouraging them as they walked inside.
"I have something for you,"
Drew said, and he reached behind his seat and held out a baseball cap, one Josie recognized. Whatever embroidery had once been on it had long since unraveled. The brim was frayed and curled tight as a fiddlehead. He handed it to Josie, who ran a finger gently along the inside seam.
"He left it in my car," Drew explained.
I was going to give it to his parents. After. But then I kind of thought you might want it instead.
Josie nodded as tears rose along the watermark of her throat. Drew bent his head against the wheel. It took Josie a moment to realize that he was crying, too. She reached out and put her hand on his shoulder.
Thank you,
Josie managed, and she settled Matt's baseball cap onto her head. She opened the passenger door and reached for her knapsack, but instead of heading toward the school, she walked through the rusted gates onto the playground. She strode into the middle of the sandbox and stared at her shoe prints, wondered how much wind or weather it would take to make them disappear. Twice, Alex had excused herself from the courtroom to call Josie's cell, even though she knew Josie kept it turned off during classroom hours. The message she left both times was the same.
It's me. I just wanted to know how you were holding up.
Alex told her clerk, Eleanor, that if Josie called back, she was to be disturbed, no matter what. She was relieved to be back at work, but had to force herself to pay attention to the case in front of her. There was a defendant on the stand who claimed to have no experience with the criminal justice system.
"I don't understand the court process," the woman said, turning to Alex. "Can I go now?"
The prosecutor was in the middle of his cross-examination.
"First, why don't you tell Judge Cormier about the last time you were in court?"
The woman hesitated.
"Maybe for a speeding ticket?"
"What else?"
"I can't remember," she said.
"Aren't you on probation?" the prosecutor asked.
"Oh,"
the woman replied.
"That."
"What are you on probation for?"
"I can't remember."
She looked up at the ceiling, her brow wrinkling in thought.
"It begins with an F. 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 Felony! That's it."
The prosecutor sighed. "Didn't it have to do with a check?" Alex looked at her watch, thinking that if she got this woman off the damn stand, she could see if Josie had called in yet.
"How about forgery?" she interrupted. "That starts with an F."
"So does fraud," the prosecutor pointed out. The woman faced Alex blankly.
"I can't remember."
"I'm calling a one-hour recess," Alex announced. "Court will resume at 11 a.m. As soon as she was through the door that took her to her chambers, she stripped off her robes. They felt suffocating today, something that Alex didn't really understand. This was where she had always felt comfortable. Law was a set of rules she understood, a code of behavior where certain actions had certain consequences. She couldn't say the same of her personal life, where a school that was supposed to be safe turned into a slaughterhouse, where a daughter carved from her own body had become someone Alex no longer understood. Okay, if she was going to be honest, that she'd never understood. Frustrated, she stood up and walked into her clerk's office. Twice, before the trial began, she'd called on Eleanor for trivial things, hoping that instead of hearing, "Yes, Your Honor," the clerk would let down her guard and ask Alex how she was doing, how Josie was doing, that for a half a moment she wouldn't be a judge to someone, just another parent who'd had the scare of a lifetime.
"I need a cigarette," Alex said. "I'm going downstairs."
Eleanor glanced up.
"All right, Your Honor."
Alex, she thought. Alex, Alex, Alex. Outside, Alex sat down on the cement block near the loading zone and lit a cigarette. She drew in deeply, closed her eyes.
"Those'll kill you, you know."
"So will old age," Alex replied, and she turned around to see Patrick Ducharme. He turned his face up to the sun, squinted.
"I wouldn't have expected a judge to have vices."
"You probably think we sleep under the bench, too."
Patrick grinned.
"Well, that would be just plain silly. There's not enough room for a mattress."
She held out the pack.
"Be my guest."
"If you want to corrupt me, there are more interesting ways."
Alex felt her face flame. He hadn't just said that, had he? To a judge?
If you don't smoke, why'd you come out here?
To photosynthesize. When I'm stuck in court all day, it ruins my feng shui.
People don't have feng shui. Places do.
Do you know that for a fact?
Alex hesitated. Well, no.
There you go.
He turned to her, and for the first time she noticed that he had a white streak in his hair, right at the widow's peak.
You're staring.
Alex immediately jerked her gaze away.
It's all right, Patrick said, laughing. It's albinism.
Albinism?
Yeah, you know, pale skin, white hair. It's recessive, so I got a skunk streak. I'm one gene away from looking like a rabbit.
He faced her, sobering.
How's Josie?
She considered putting up that Chinese wall, telling him she didn't want to talk about anything that could compromise her case. But Patrick Ducharme had done the one thing Alex had wished for. He'd treated her like a person instead of a public figure.
She went back to school, Alex confided.
I know. I saw her.
You were there?
Patrick shrugged.
Yeah, just in case.
Did anything happen?
No, he said. It was ordinary.
The word hung between them. Nothing was going to be ordinary again, and both of them knew it. You could patch up whatever was broken, but if you were the one who had fixed it, you'd always know in your heart where the fault lines lay.
Hey, Patrick said, touching her shoulder. Are you all right?
She realized, mortified, that she was crying. Wiping her eyes, Alex moved out of his reach.
There's nothing wrong with me, she said, daring Patrick to challenge her.
He opened his mouth as if he was about to speak, but then snapped it shut.
I'll leave you to your vices, then, he said,
and walked back inside. It wasn't until Alex was back in chambers that she realized the detective had used the plural, that he'd not only caught her smoking, but also lying. There were new rules. All the doors except for the main entrance would be locked after school began, even though a shooter who was a student might already be inside. No backpacks were allowed in classrooms anymore, although a gun could be sneaked in under a coat or in a purse, or even in a zippered three-ring binder. Everyone, students and staff, would get ID cards to wear around their necks. It was supposed to make everyone accountable, but Josie couldn't help but wonder if this way, next time, it would be easier to tell who had been killed. The principal got on the loudspeaker during homeroom and welcomed everyone back to Sterling High, even if it wasn't Sterling High. He suggested a moment of silence. While other kids in her homeroom bowed their heads, Josie glanced around. She wasn't the only one who wasn't praying. Some kids were passing notes. A couple were listening to their iPods. A guy was copying someone else's math notes. She wondered if they, like her, were afraid to honor the dead because it made them feel more guilty. Josie shifted, banging her knee against the desk. The desks and chairs that had been brought back to this makeshift school were for little children, not high school refugees. As a result, nobody fit. Josie's knees were bent up to her chin. Some kids couldn't even sit at the desks. They had to write with their binders on their laps.
I am Alice in Wonderland, Josie thought.
Watch me fall.
Jordan waited for his client to sit down across from him in the conference room of the jail.
Tell me about your brother, Peter, he said.
He scrutinized Peter's face, saw the disappointment flash across it as he realized that Jordan had again unearthed something he'd hoped would stay hidden.
What about him? Peter replied.
You two get along?
I didn't kill him, if that's what you're asking.
I wasn't.
Jordan shrugged.
I'm just surprised you didn't mention him earlier.
Peter glared at him. Like when? When I was supposed to shut up at the arraignment? Or after that, when you came here and told me you were going to do all the talking and I was going to listen? What was he like?
Look, Joey's dead, which you obviously know, so I don't really get why talking about him is going to help me.
What happened to him? Jordan pressed.
Peter rubbed his thumbnail against the metal edging of the table.
He got his golden boy straight-A self rammed by a drunk driver.
Hard to beat that, Jordan said carefully.
What do you mean?
Well, your brother is the perfect kid, right? That's tough enough right there, but then he dies and turns into a saint.
Jordan had been playing devil's advocate to see if Peter would take the bait, and sure enough, the boy's face transformed.
You can't beat it, Peter said fiercely. You can't measure up.
Jordan tapped his pencil on the edge of his briefcase. Had Peter's anger been born of jealousy or loneliness? Or was his massacre a way to turn attention to himself, finally, instead of Joey? How could he formulate a defense that Peter's act was one of desperation, not an attempt to one-up his brother's notoriety?
Do you miss him?
Jordan asked. Peter smirked.
My brother, he said. My brother, the captain of the baseball team. My brother who placed first in the state in a French competition. My brother who was friends with the principal. My brother, my fabulous brother, used to drop me off a half mile away from the gates of the high school so that he didn't have to be seen driving all the way in with me.
How come?
You don't exactly get any perks for hanging around with me. Or haven't you noticed yet?
Jordan had a flash of his car tires slashed to their metal haunches.
Joey wouldn't stick up for you if you were being bullied?
Are you kidding? Joey was the one to start it.
How?
Peter walked toward the window in the small room. A mottled flush rose up his neck, as if memory could be burned into the flesh.
He used to tell people I was adopted, that my mother was a crack whore, and that's why my brain was all fucked up. Sometimes he did it right in front of me, and when I'd get pissed off and wail on him, he'd just laugh and knock me on my ass. And then he'd look back to his friends, as if this was proof of everything he'd been saying in the first place.
So, do I miss him?
Peter repeated, and he faced Jordan.
I'm glad he's dead.
Jordan wasn't often surprised, and yet Peter Houghton had shocked him several times already. Peter was, simply, what a person would look like if you boiled down the most raw emotions and filtered them of any social contract. If you hurt, cry. If you rage, strike out. If you hope, get ready for a disappointment.
Peter, Jordan murmured, did you mean to kill them?
Immediately, Jordan cursed himself. He'd just asked the one question a defense attorney is never supposed to ask, setting Peter up to admit to premeditation. But instead of answering, Peter threw a question back at him that had just as unsettling an answer.
Well, he said, what would you have done?
Jordan stuffed another bite of vanilla pudding into Sam's mouth and then licked the spoon himself.
That's not for you, Selena said.
It tastes good, unlike that pea crap you make him eat.
Excuse me for being a good mother.
Selena took a wet washcloth and wiped down Sam's mouth, then applied the same treatment to Jordan, who squirmed away from her hand.
I'm totally screwed, he said. I can't make Peter sympathetic over losing his brother, because he hated Joey. I don't even have a valid legal defense for him, unless I try for insanity, and it's going to be impossible to prove that with the mountain of evidence the prosecution's got for premeditation.
Selena turned to him.
You know what the problem is here, don't you?
What?
You think he's guilty.
Well, for Christ's sake, so are 99% of my clients, and it's never stopped me from getting acquittals before.
Right. But deep down, You don't want Peter Houghton to get acquitted.
Jordan frowned. That's crap.
It's true crap. You're scared of someone like him.
He's a kid.
Who freaks you out? Just a little bit. Because he wasn't willing to sit down and let the world shit on him anymore. And that's not supposed to happen.
Jordan looked up at her. Shooting 10 students doesn't make you a hero, Selena.
It does to the millions of other kids who wished they'd had the guts to do it, she said flatly.
Excellent. You can be the leader of Peter Houghton's fan club.
I don't condone what he did, Jordan, but I do see where he's coming from. You were born with 6 silver spoons up your ass. I mean, honestly, have you ever not been in the elite group? At school, or in court, or wherever? People know you. People look up to you. You're granted passage, and you don't even realize that other people never get to walk that way.
Jordan folded his arms. Are you about to do your African pride thing again? Because to tell you the truth,
you've never gone down the street and had someone cross it just because you're black. You've never had someone look at you with disgust because you're holding a baby and you forgot to put on your wedding ring. You want to do something about it. Take action. Scream at them. Tell them they're idiots. But you can't. Being on the fringe is the most disempowering feeling, Jordan. You get so used to the world being a certain way, there seems to be no escape from it.
Jordan smirked. You took that last part from my closing in the Katie Riccobono case.
The battered wife?
Selena shrugged.
Well, even if I did, it fits.
Suddenly, Jordan blinked. He stood up, grabbed his wife, and kissed her.
You are so fucking brilliant.
I'm not going to argue, but do tell me why.
Battered woman syndrome. It's a valid legal defense. Battered women get stuck in a world that slams them down. Eventually, they feel so constantly threatened that they take action and truly believe they're protecting themselves, even if their husbands are fast asleep. That fits Peter Houghton to a T.
Far be it from me to point this out to you, Jordan, Selena said. But Peter's not female, and he's not married.
That's not the point. It's post-traumatic stress disorder. When these women go ballistic and shoot their husbands or slice off their dicks, they aren't thinking about the consequences, just about stopping the aggression. That's what Peter's been saying all along. He just wanted it to stop.
And this is even better, because I don't have to fight the prosecutor's usual rebuttal about a grown woman being old enough to know what she's doing when she picks up the knife or the gun. Peter's a kid. By definition, he doesn't know what he's doing.
Monsters didn't grow out of nowhere. A housewife didn't turn into a murderer unless someone turned her into one. The Dr. Frankenstein, in her case, was a controlling husband. And in Peter's case, it was the whole of Sterling High School. Bullies kicked and teased and punched and pinched, all behaviors meant to force someone back where he belonged. It was at the hands of his tormentors that Peter learned how to fight back. In the high chair, Sam started to fuss. Selena pulled him out and into her arms.
No one's ever done this, she said. There is no bullied victim syndrome.
Jordan reached for Sam's jar of vanilla custard and scraped out the leftovers with his forefinger.
There is now, he said, and he savored the last of the sweet.
Patrick sat at his office computer in the dark, moving a cursor through the video game created by Peter Houghton. You started by picking a character, one of 3 boys, the spelling bee champ, the math genius, the computer nerd. One was small and thin with acne. One wore glasses. One was grossly overweight. You didn't come equipped with a weapon. Instead, you had to go to various rooms of the school and use your wits. The teacher's lounge had vodka to make hand grenades. The boiler room had a bazooka. The science lab had burning acid. The English classroom had heavy books. The math room had compasses for stabbing and metal rulers for slicing. The computer room had wires for garrots. The woodshop had chainsaws. The home arts class had blenders and knitting needles. The art room had a kiln. You could combine materials to make combo assault weapons, flaming bullets from the bazooka and vodka, acid daggers from the chemicals and compasses, snares from the computer wires and the heavy books. Patrick maneuvered the cursor through hallways and up staircases, through locker rooms and into the janitor's office. It struck him, as he was turning virtual corners, that he'd walked this map before. It was the floor plan of Sterling High. The object of the game was to aim for the jocks, the bullies, and the popular kids. Each was worth a certain amount of points. Kill two at once, you got triple the points. However, you could be wounded too. You might be sucker punched, slammed into a wall, shoved in a locker. If you accrued 100,000 points, you got a shotgun. If you reached 500,000 points, you received a machine gun. Cross a million, and you'd find yourself straddling a nuclear missile. Patrick watched a virtual door fly open. "Freeze!" his speakers cried, and a phalanx of policemen in SWAT jackets stormed onto the screen. He positioned his hand on the arrow keys again, readying himself. Twice now, he'd gotten this far and had been killed or had killed himself, which meant losing. This time, though, he raised his virtual machine gun and watched the officers fall in a spray of bright blood. "Congratulations! You have won Hide and Shriek," the screen read. "Do you want to play again?" On the 10th day after the shooting at Sterling High, Jordan sat in his Volvo in the parking lot of the district courthouse. As he'd expected, there were white news vans everywhere. Their satellites pointed to the sky like the faces of sunflowers. He tapped his fingers on the steering wheel in time to the Wiggles CD, which was doing its effortless job of keeping Sam from throwing a fit in the back seat. Selena had already slipped into the court undeterred. No one in the media would recognize her as anyone connected to this case. As she approached the car again, Jordan got out and took the piece of paper she offered him. "Great," he said. "See you later." She bent down to unbuckle Sam from the car seat as Jordan headed into the courthouse. As soon as one reporter saw him, there was a domino effect. Flashbulbs burst like a string of fireworks. Microphones were thrust in front of him. He pushed them away with one outstretched arm, muttered, "No comment," and hustled inside. Peter had already been brought to the holding cell of the sheriff's office, awaiting his appearance in court. He was pacing in a small circle, talking to himself, when Jordan was brought into the cell. "So, today's the day," Peter said, a little nervous, a little breathless.
"Funny you should mention that," Jordan said. "Do you remember why we're here today?"
"Is this some kind of test?"
Jordan just stared at him.
"A probable cause hearing," Peter said. "That's what you told me last week."
"Well, what I didn't tell you is that we're going to waive it."
"Waive it?" Peter said. "What does that mean?"
"It means we fold before the hands even played," Jordan replied. He handed Peter the piece of paper Selena had brought him in the car.
"Sign it."
Peter shook his head.
"I want a new lawyer."
"Anyone worth their salt is going to tell you the same thing."
"What, to give up without even trying? You said..."
"I said I'd give you the best defense I can," Jordan interrupted.
"There's already probable cause to believe that you committed a crime, since there are hundreds of witnesses claiming to have seen you shooting in the school that day. The issue isn't whether or not you did it, Peter. It's why you did it. Having a probable cause hearing today means they score a lot of points, and we score none. It would just be a way for the prosecution to release evidence to the media and the public before they get a chance to hear our side of the story."
He thrust the paper at Peter again.
"Sign it."
Peter met his gaze, fuming. Then he took the paper from Jordan and a pen.
This sucks, he said as he scrawled his signature.
It would suck more if we did the probable cause hearing.
Jordan took the paper and left the cell, heading out of the sheriff's office to give the waiver to the clerk.
I'll see you in there.
By the time he reached the courtroom, it was packed to the rafters. The media that had been allowed in stood in the back row, their cameras ready. Jordan sought out Selena. She was juggling Sam in the middle of the third row behind the prosecution's table.
So? She asked, a shorthand lift of her brows.
Jordan nodded the slightest bit.
Done.
The judge presiding was inconsequential to him, someone who would rubber-stamp this process and turn it over to the court where Jordan would have to put on his dog and pony show. The Honorable David Iannucci. What Jordan remembered about him was that he had hair plugs, and when you appeared before him, you had to do your absolute best to keep your eyes trained on his ferret face instead of on the seated line of his scalp. The clerk called Peter's case, and two bailiffs led him through a doorway. The gallery, which had been buzzing with their quiet conversation, fell silent. Peter didn't look up as he entered. He continued to stare at the ground, even as he was shuttled into place beside Jordan. Judge Iannucci scanned the paper that had been set in front of him.
I see, Mr. Houghton, that you wish to waive your probable cause hearing.
At this news, as Jordan had expected, there was a collective sigh from the media, all of whom had been hoping for a spectacle.
Do you understand that I would have had the obligation today to find whether or not there was probable cause to believe that you committed the acts for which you were charged, and that by waiving the probable cause hearing, you are not requiring me to find that probable cause? You will now be bound over to the grand jury, and I will bind this case over to the Superior Court.
Peter turned to Jordan.
Was that English?
Say yes, Jordan answered.
Yes, Peter repeated.
Judge Iannucci stared at him.
Yes, Your Honor, he corrected.
Yes, Your Honor.
Peter turned to Jordan again and, under his breath, muttered,
This still sucks.
You're excused, the judge said, and the bailiffs hefted Peter out of his seat again.
Jordan stood, giving way to the next defense attorney for the next case. He approached Diana Levin at the prosecutor's table, still organizing the files she never had a chance to use.
Well,
she said, not bothering to look up at him,
I can't say that was a surprise.
When are you going to send me discovery? Jordan asked.
I don't remember getting your letter requesting it yet. She pushed past him, hurrying up the aisle. Jordan made a mental note to get Selena to type something up and send it off to the prosecutor's office, a formality, but one that he knew Diana would uphold. In a case this big, the DA followed every rule to the letter, so that if the case ever went up on appeal, procedure would not be the downfall of the original verdict. Just outside the double doors of the courtroom, he was waylaid by the Houghtons.
What the hell was that? Lewis demanded. Aren't we paying you to work in court?
Jordan counted to five under his breath.
I spoke about this with my client, Peter. He gave me permission to waive the hearing.
But you didn't say anything, Lacey argued. You didn't even give him a chance.
Today's hearing wouldn't have benefited Peter. It would, however, have put your family under the microscope of every camera outside the courthouse today. That's going to happen anyway. Did you really want it to be sooner rather than later?
He looked from Lacey Houghton to her husband, and then back again.
I did you a favor, Jordan said,
and he left them holding the truth between them, a stone that got heavier with every passing moment. Patrick had been heading to the probable cause hearing for Peter Houghton when he received a cell phone call that sent him screaming in the opposite direction to Smith's gun shop in Plainfield. The owner of the store,
A round little man with a tobacco-stained beard was sitting outside on the curb, sobbing, when Patrick arrived. Beside him was a patrol officer who jerked